a teenager is missing. A police investigation exposes the deaths of dozens of boys and young men. All are traced to a single killer. A photographer turns to rape and torture, meticulously documenting his crimes on film and audio tape. In a quiet suburb, four people are found dead. Police wonder about the kind of madman who could commit this crime. For serial killers, one death is just the beginning. Obsessed, they strike again and again, learning more with each crime, improving, perfecting. They're confident they'll never be stopped. But the mind hunters work tirelessly for their capture. Just after 6 o'clock on January 23rd, 1978, in California, when Sacramento County Police arrive at the home of Terry and David Wallen. They are called there by a neighbor at David's frantic request. 22-year-old Terry Wallen has been brutally murdered. The house shows signs of an intense struggle between Wallen and her killer. She has been shot and her body slashed. A large knife wound runs the length of her torso. Some of her internal organs have been removed. Investigators are horrified by the viciousness of the crime. The scene becomes more gruesome when they find evidence that suggests the killer might have consumed Wallen's blood. Officers find a yogurt cup with bloody lip prints around the rim. Sacramento police don't know what to make of the scene, but they know who can help them. They call on a specialist, a man who's familiar with horrific and bizarre murder cases. His name is Russ Vorpagel. He is a special agent with the FBI. The brutality of the slaying makes Vorpagel fear that the murderer couldn't control himself and that Terry Wallen's death may be just the beginning of his rampage.
There's just no need to disembowel a victim. There's no need to reach inside and cut out body parts. There's no need to cut a 4-inch piece of major artery and take it along with you. I mean, hey, we knew we had a nut and we were worried and we knew that something's gonna happen.
Vorpagel called a colleague at the FBI. Robert Ressler has tracked and caught some of the world's most dangerous killers. As a criminal profiler for the FBI, he stakes out the darkest corners of a killer's mind. In the 1970s, he was one of the first to use the term serial killer to describe those who murder again and again. Robert Ressler is a mind hunter. Ressler struggles to understand the killer's mind by studying the crime scene. Knowing how the killer thinks is essential to predicting his next move. When will he strike? Who will he target?
You have to have a emotional need to solve a crime. You have to want to know who the offender was. You have to know what that person is, what he's like, what he was like before, during, and after the crime.
But there is a danger in identifying too closely with those who destroy. Ressler heeds the words of German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who wrote that whoever fights monsters should not become a monster himself. And that when one looks into an abyss, the unblinking abyss stares directly back. For Robert Ressler, Nietzsche's observation is motivation and warning.
Looking into the abyss to me means looking into the depths, the deep crevices, the dark crevices of man's human mind. And when it says the abyss looks back, to me that means I'm looking back at myself. I'm seeing my reflection. Because in every horrible killer, yourself is in there somewhere in part. Somewhere in your life you could have gone that same road.
In the 1970s, Ressler was among the original members of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, the first FBI program to systematically research a killer's motivations. Ressler interviewed some of America's most notorious murderers in prison to learn about their habits and attitudes. Today, Ressler is a private consultant who works all over the world to help solve serial murders. In January of 1978, Ressler applied his knowledge to help Sacramento County investigators devise a psychological profile of Terry Wallen's murderer. It was the first step in tracking the killer. Ressler began his profile by examining the crime scene details.
What you look for at a crime scene is the positioning of the body, the way the body was left by the killer. You look at the state of the body, from the standpoint of being clothed or unclothed, and of course you're looking for available weaponry, or did the killer take a weapon to the scene, use it and take it away? These are all things that you really start sizing up in your head.
After Terry Wallen was shot, the killer cut her body with knives taken from her own kitchen. Then he left them in plain sight at the scene, a detail that would prove instructive for Ressler. Because the greatest number of serial killers are male, at the time, Vorpegel and Ressler conclude their suspect is a man. They also assume he's white, like the majority of American serial killers. The brutality of the crime and the killer's apparent disregard for leaving evidence behind convince the pair their subject is mentally ill. That helps them pinpoint the killer's age. Ressler knows that mental illness usually begins in adolescence. It would take at least 8 years for the killer to grow sick enough to perform the acts of violence he inflicted on Terry Wallen. Assuming symptoms began at age 15, Ressler figures the killer would be in his mid to late 20s. Any older, and he would have already committed several gruesome homicides. Ressler goes further. He believes the killer to be schizophrenic, a mental illness characterized by delusions, hallucinations, and bizarre behavior. The heinous nature of the crime points to full-blown psychosis, a total loss of contact with reality. Because he drinks the blood of his victims, investigators call him the vampire killer. From his office in Virginia, Ressler works feverishly with Vorpegel in Sacramento to refine the killer's profile. What would he look like? They are convinced police should look for someone thin. Male schizophrenics generally eat poorly when they eat at all. And Russ Vorpegel believes the murderer will pay little attention to his appearance.
A guy that is suffering from a major mental illness is probably going to have a deterioration in his hygiene. Probably doesn't cut his hair, wears the same clothes for weeks at a time, doesn't brush his teeth, is scroungy looking.
Given his bizarre behavior, the killer would likely live alone. Vorpegel delivers a copy of the profile to the Sacramento police to circulate throughout the county. But no strong suspect emerges. the vampire killer remains at large. Will the profilers find him before he kills again?
Sir.
3 days after Terry Wallen's brutal murder in 1978, less than a mile away from her house, the vampire killer strikes again. Police find the bodies of Daniel Meredith, Evelyn Miroff, and her son Jason. Missing and presumed dead is Miroff's 22-month-old nephew, Michael Ferriera. These new deaths convince Ressler and Vorpegel that unless this murderer is found quickly, he will strike again. The Mindhunters redouble their efforts. Using information gathered from this crime scene, they refine their original profile. Again, the vampire killer shot his victims. Again, he used knives taken from the victim's kitchen. Two knives are found in the room, and another was found outside. He doesn't seem to care that he's left the weapons behind. These details tell profilers that the killer is not planning his crimes. Although he brings a gun, he cuts the bodies with weapons he finds at the scene and then leaves them there.
What we got there?
We have a knife that was used to mutilate the bodies. It was taken from the kitchen, used on the victim, and then discarded at the crime scene. Seeing this for a second time definitely reinforced in my mind that we were dealing with a highly disorganized killer.
Organized and disorganized.
Careful.
These words describe a serial killer's behavior before, during, and after a murder. Organized serial killers carefully plot their moves. They cover their trail so thoroughly that little or no evidence remains to tie them to their crimes. By contrast, disorganized serial killers act on impulse. Their behavior is random, making their next move difficult to predict. Investigators find bloodstains in the bathtub. Profilers believe the vampire killer may have bathed in a mixture of water and blood. The crimes are becoming more gruesome and the killer more deranged and more disorganized.
Now, we know darn well that your normal everyday person is not going to fill a tub with water and bathe in the blood. So here we see personality. Here we see mental illness. We see mental deterioration.
From the evidence at the crime scene, Vorpegel and Ressler reconstruct the grisly sequence of events. And the terrifying portrait of a man they've never seen begins to emerge. The evidence reinforces the Mindhunter's belief that the vampire killer's appearance will continue to deteriorate. He likely won't have changed his clothes. Unless he is single and living alone, the killer can't possibly escape notice. Their subject is a thin, disheveled loner, not more than 30 years old. Investigators are puzzled when murder victim Daniel Meredith's stolen red station wagon turns up a short distance away. Because it was found nearby, Ressler determines the vampire killer must have walked to the crime scene and then fled on foot after abandoning the car.
The killer would be residing within a very close distance to that abandoned car. I said approximately 1/4 mile.
The day after the Miroff murders, police receive an unrelated report that a dog has been shot and mutilated within blocks of the crime scene. For the Mindhunters, it's the break they've been looking for. They know that as children, serial killers often mutilate or kill animals.
And he would go out and kill these pets, shooting them with the same gun he shot Wallen and Miroth and Meredith. Same gun, he'd shoot these pets. And then he'd gut them and drink their blood.
As more animals are found dead, the circle closes. The Mindhunters are convinced that the vampire killer lives near the slaughtered animals and his human victims. He won't have traveled far. Police circulate the revised profile throughout the city in hopes that someone may have seen a disheveled or strange-acting man. Officers concentrate on a quarter-mile radius of the murders. As a woman in her late 20s is leaving a Sacramento shopping center, a strange man approaches her. Hearing of the vampire killer murders, the woman contacts police. The man she eluded at the shopping center, she tells officers, is a former high school classmate, Richard Trenton Chase. She was shocked by his appearance. He had bloodstains on his sweatshirt. His eyes seemed sunk into their sockets. A yellowed crust was around his mouth. According to the woman's description, Chase fits the profile of the vampire killer. Armed with a search warrant, officers enter Chase's home. They're unprepared for what they find. Nazi paraphernalia dominates the small apartment. The place is littered with pamphlets about alien conspiracies. The chaos in the living room fits the profile of someone with an equally chaotic mind. In the kitchen, police find appliances spattered with blood, as well as newspaper articles about the murder of Terry Wallen. Several dishes in the refrigerator contain human tissue. In a kitchen drawer are knives taken from Wallen's home. Investigators also find a toolbox and blood-stained rubber boots. Chase is arrested and charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder, including the killing of Evelyn Miroth's nephew, 22-month-old Michael Ferriera, whose remains are found not far from Chase's apartment. The jury deliberates only a few hours before pronouncing Chase guilty on all counts. The sentence? Death in the electric chair. In 1979, Robert Ressler decided to talk to Chase in prison.
The reason I interviewed him, very frankly, was to validate, to do an update and validate the profiling work that I had done, to talk to him directly after working on the case, after seeing the crime scenes, after reading the police reports, and of course the court records. It's a way you really fine-tune your profiling.
Chase tells Ressler that he had killed only to preserve his own life. He needed blood, Chase says, to survive what he called soap dish poisoning. Chase believed that a gooey residue under his soap dish proved he was dying. He claimed his blood was drying out and corroding his body. His killings, Chase contended, were made in self-defense.
When he got down to the motivation, he said that the blood in his veins, the blood throughout his entire body, was turning to powder or dust, and that it was moving very slowly through his body, causing him to slow down, causing him to be fatigued and become very ill. And he felt this was being done, of course, he said, by the influence of the unidentified flying objects and the aliens. And he said that the only way he could counter this was to get a fresh supply of human blood.
What drives a man like Chase to murder? One FBI study of 36 serial killers revealed that although most began life in two-parent homes, by age two, almost half the boys' fathers had abandoned their families. Nearly half of the surveyed offenders reported cold or uncaring relationships with their mothers. 26 reported such relationships with their fathers. Nearly 70% of the families had histories of alcohol abuse. One-third had histories of drug abuse. Almost all reported some form of childhood psychological, physical, or sexual abuse. As children, many serial killers tortured animals. The majority did not graduate from high school. While the men had the required intelligence to perform skilled jobs, most had poor work histories. Only 20%, or six offenders, had ever managed to hold on to steady work. Yet, to all appearances, serial killers seem normal, like your neighbor or your friend.
Most of these people are like everyday people. They oftentimes are intelligent, they're attractive, they're good conversationalists. IQs usually up about at least high normal or beyond, and they're very deceptive.
Ressler was opposed to the death sentence for Chase. Chase, he argued, was mentally ill and should have been locked up for life in a prison hospital. Prison psychiatrists eventually agreed. Chase's sentence was commuted to life in the California Medical Facility in Vacaville. But Chase killed himself in his prison cell just after Christmas, 1980. He had stockpiled his antidepressant pills and then taken them all at once. Richard Trenton Chase's brief and chaotic reign of terror had come to an end. In contrast, one of America's most cunning serial killers was also one of the most organized. Highly intelligent and a talented photographer, this murderer specialized in kidnapping, rape, and torture. Police called him the unidentified subject, or unsub. He was a master of planning. He used film and audio tape to record his crimes. In a rented storage shed, he stockpiled pictures of his victims and recordings of their anguished cries. He was so meticulous that he would leave virtually no evidence of his atrocities, except for the photographs he took himself. Unsub customized his cars to resemble unmarked police cars. He added heavy-duty suspensions and strong restraints so that once inside, his victims had virtually no chance of escape. For 5 years, he traveled from state to state, never staying in one place too long. He was self-reliant, financing his crimes of kidnapping, rape, and torture with yet another crime. He was a skilled counterfeiter. He was confident that he would never be caught. In Manassas, Virginia, a team of former FBI agents pursue some of the world's most dangerous criminals. They call themselves the Academy Group. Between them, they have amassed years of experience investigating serial killings. Robert Hazelwood and Peter Smerick are experts in psychological profiling of criminals.
If you in life are an impulsive person, you act without thinking, well then that crime scene may be very, very sloppy and be a reflection of your impulsive acts. On the other hand, if in life you're a cold, calculating individual, you don't take any unnecessary risks, well that type of behavior can also be demonstrated at a crime scene.
Even with crime scene evidence, categorizing serial killers is difficult. Some serial killers demonstrate a mixture of disorganized and organized habits.
All too often, If an investigator starts looking at a crime scene and tries to put the offender into one of these nice, neat little categories, he's going to be disappointed when the person he arrests doesn't fit these categories in all areas.
In the seaside resort of Ocean City, Maryland, a young woman has just finished her shift at a convenience store. It is Memorial Day weekend, 1979. She is approached by a man who identifies himself as a police officer. He shows her his identification and is driving an unmarked police car. He tells the woman she is a suspect in a series of robberies, and he insists that she accompany him to police headquarters for questioning. He handcuffs her and pushes her into the car. It's the beginning of the longest and most terrifying experience of the woman's life. The man is no police officer. He is unsub. And she's his latest victim. He takes her to a deserted building where he repeatedly rapes and tortures her. He photographs and tape records the ordeal.
I think one of the buzzwords today that we use is power and control. And whether you're dealing with a rapist, whether you're dealing with a serial killer, I think it still comes down to those two basic elements: power and control over the life of another individual.
Eventually, he will push the dazed woman back into his car and take her for one last ride.
He stops the automobile, opens up the passenger door, and rolls the woman out into a ditch. But he did not kill her. He allowed this victim to live. And as a result, within a number of hours when daylight came, she was found, she was rescued, and now became a full-fledged FBI investigation for kidnapping.
The FBI set up a massive manhunt for Unsub. The Ocean City woman was the latest in a long list of his victims. Some were tortured, others murdered. But many years passed before there was a break in the case. At the same time the FBI searched for Unsub, the Secret Service was on the trail of an elusive counterfeiter, a man who routinely passed fake $20 bills to unsuspecting store clerks at malls and shops in the Midwest and on the East Coast.
The one thing about any law enforcement agency, no matter how good we are, you need an element of luck, and you need the cooperation of an alert citizenry. In this instance, an alert clerk recognized a composite sketch as a customer who was currently in the store. She notified mall security notified local authorities, and within a short period of time, the suspect was apprehended.
The man police arrest is James Mitchell DeBartolaben. The Secret Service soon discovers that DeBartolaben is not just a counterfeiter. Secret Service agents search a storage unit rented by DeBartolaben. Inside are sheaves of the fake currency he's been passing. But to their shock, agents also discover a grotesque treasure trove of pictures and audio tape. The 1983 discovery unmasks the focus of the FBI investigation. Robert Hazelwood, then an FBI special agent who had written a criminal profile of Unsub, reviewed the materials seized from DeBartolaben's storage unit. Agents find thousands of photographs of DeBartolaben's victims. Among them are photos and audio tape of the woman abducted in Ocean City in 1979. Some of the photos date back to the early 1960s. They find the tools of a killer's trade. Victim's clothing, 10 guns, phony police identification, journals, blood-stained lingerie, and jewelry. 7 license plates allowed DeBartoleben to roam with little fear of his car being traced. The FBI also found handwritten notes. They contained codes that referred to past and future crimes. Although they have uncovered DeBartoleben's cache of damning images and sounds, agents have a problem. The killer's face remains literally out of the frame of the pictures he's taken with the victims. Investigators will have to prove DeBartoleben is the man in the photographs if they are to tie him conclusively to the rapes and deaths. During his FBI career, Peter Smerick was a forensic photography expert. The Secret Service sent him a number of DeBartoleben's photos to analyze. Several show a naked torso and uncovered arms. Smerick focuses his attention on the arms. They have a distinctive pattern of small moles and freckles. Smerick asks the Secret Service to temporarily remove DeBartoleben from his prison cell in order to photograph him in the same position as the person in the confiscated photos. The gambit pays off. When Smerick compares the photographs taken by the Secret Service to the ones found in the storage unit, he finds the patterns of freckles match. It's the proof agents desperately seek.
In all the years that I've worked as a criminal profiler, I can't think of another case where the offender was such an excellent photographer that unknowingly he took his own crime scene photographs, which ended up putting him in prison.
In 1984, DeBartoleben was tried and convicted. Today, he is in a federal penitentiary in Texas, sentenced to multiple life terms.
DeBartoleben is one of the most dangerous criminals that ever walked the face of the earth, in my opinion. He was able to commit a number of crimes over a number of years in a variety of states and never have those crimes linked to him. That made him extremely dangerous. I think he's involved in a lot more crimes than we're aware of, yes.
By controlling every variable, weapons, location, and victim, the organized serial killer can slip through any dragnet, getting away with murder for years as he hides in plain sight. Such was the case of John Wayne Gacy, a prominent Chicago-area businessman. Well-liked and respected, Gacy camouflaged a terrible secret. In 1978, in Des Plaines, Illinois, 15-year-old Robert Peast was reported missing. Having learned that Gacy was preparing a remodeling bid for a drugstore where Peast worked, Chief Detective Joseph Kozenzak of the Des Plaines Police Department goes to Gacy's home. Gacy denies knowing Peast. But investigators are suspicious. A background check reveals Gacy was once convicted of the sexual abuse of a teenage boy. Kozenzak places Gacy under surveillance. Initially cooperative with the police, Gacy becomes increasingly surly as Kozenzak's investigation continues.
He had a real mean look in his eyes. You could feel that there was hatred there, and that he really didn't care what we were investigating and was more concerned about trying to stay out of the way.
Gacy threatens a lawsuit if police continue their surveillance. Officers persist, suspecting that Gacy has much to hide. But even they are not prepared for what they'll find. For several weeks in 1978, Des Plaines police didn't let John Wayne Gacy out of their sight. Finally, it came time to search his house. The search uncovers a photo receipt that belonged to Robert Peast, linking Gacy to the boy's disappearance. A more thorough search would reveal even more. Chief Detective Kozenczak was the first to enter Gacy's home.
I was one of the first people that arrived at the house and went in through the back door, walked in. The whole place was just dark and kind of eerie. All the window blinds had been closed. And there was some sense of, it was kind of ominous, actually, because we were starting to believe that there could be people buried underneath Gacy's house based on the information we'd gathered.
Police interviewed Gacy's ex-wife, friends, and former employees. Stories came out that Gacy propositioned his workers for sexual favors, that some had disappeared, and that his house had a strange odor. One of his workers suggests they check the crawl space. After rigorous questioning, Gacy admits to detectives that 4 years earlier, in 1974, he killed one of his homosexual partners. Gacy claims the murder was in self-defense. He hid the man's body beneath the floor. Then, Gacy shocks investigators. He confesses that he murdered almost three dozen young men and boys, also hiding many of their bodies under the floor. The confessions trigger an intense search for the missing men. Detectives examine the crawl space in the hope of finding Gacy's victims. They uncover three decomposing bodies and parts of other bodies. But the police don't stop with the crawl space. Knowing more bodies must be stashed under the house, they cut away the floor to find them. Eventually, they would find bodies buried under the dining room and garage floor. Under the house is a virtual killing field of buried bones and jumbled skeletons. Police arrest Gacy for the murder of Robert Peast, though the bodies they uncovered were dead too long to be the missing boy.
Gacy, he figured that the best way not to get caught for his crimes was to keep control of his victims after death. But when you're a psychopath, a sexual psychopath, he figured nobody would ever find those bodies down there because he was too smart, smarter than police, smarter than everybody.
By stashing his victims in his own home, Gacy maintained total control over them, even in death, and could remain confident that no one would ever find them without his knowledge. Such careful attention to detail, from planning to death, is the mark of a highly organized killer.
Everything about the case, especially when viewing the home inside, would indicate that Gacy was highly methodical, very well planned, and that he had thought these crimes out in great detail prior to embarking upon them.
Gacy also dumped his victims in the Des Plaines River. Police recovered six more bodies there. One of them was Robert Peast. When it was over, police identified the remains of 33 people.
Bob was very interested in this process because the FBI was formulating within their behavioral science unit kind of an in-depth study of people who commit a series of killings and wanting to know more about them, wanting to understand them, and this was a classic case.
The goal of the FBI's behavioral science unit is to map the mind of the serial killer.
So many people believe that it's the sexual act itself that he's performing with the victim that is of primary importance to him. In reality, it's the entire game that's important to them. The selection process, the surveillance, knowing that I have selected you to become my victim and you don't know it. And then all of the planning that goes into the stages of actually conducting the abduction. And so they are rehearsing this and living this maybe for weeks or months before the actual abduction occurs. And to a certain extent, the sexual activity afterwards may almost be an aftermath.
That's gotta hurt.
With each killing, Gacy refined his methods, learned from his mistakes, and improved on his successes. He carefully lured his victims into a well-designed trap, distracting them with weightlifting, plying them with alcohol, and showing pornographic movies.
Bring it down to your chest, all the way down. Okay, can you bring it up? Can you lift it up?
He eventually grew so confident that he brazenly targeted a boy from his own neighborhood. Many victims came to Gacy's home hoping to get a job with his contracting firm. He'd meet with them in his garage. The soundproof garage was designed by Gacy and constructed by his company. A motorized door was the only way in or out. If his victim didn't object, Gacy would demonstrate a magic trick using trick handcuffs.
Like this, real good, right? Okay, ready?
After showing how the handcuffs work, Gacy would persuade his victim to try them.
Ready? All right. Now, you did it the easy way, hard way.
Then he would challenge him to attempt the trick behind his back. If the victim agreed, the trap was sprung. Gacy would switch the trick handcuffs for real ones. Once immobilized, the victim was at Gacy's mercy.
Hey, come on, man. One, two, three, twist it.
Only Gacy knows exactly what happened next.
Relax.
Come on, Bobby, relax. Okay.
Like serial rapist and killer James Mitchell DeBartolaben, Gacy thought he had completely covered his tracks. But mementos found during the search of Gacy's home provided key evidence, though police didn't know it at the time. Detectives discovered driver's licenses, belt buckles, rings, and other personal effects. Ressler alerted investigators to the importance of these objects.
We had actually found these items, not fully realizing what we had found, till after Bob came in and started pointing out to us that to you a belt buckle is not important, but to the person who committed the crime, it's very important. It's a visual process to help relive the crime at any given time that he wants to do so.
The souvenirs are a reminder of his past murders and an inspiration to kill again.
To Gacy, this is some sort of a symbol of his success, a reminder. It enhances his fantasy and carries him on to the next victim. Trophies, I call them, for the serial killer, where they kind of enhances their fantasy to have these objects around.
The most disturbing object found in Gacy's house was a map indicating job sites around the United States where he had worked as a contractor. Ressler believes it's likely that Gacy wouldn't have confined his killings to Chicago.
And it only seemed logical that if Gacy's traveling doing this in Chicago, he's doing it elsewhere as well. That's why I firmly believe that John Gacy killed more than the 33 he was convicted of. I think probably maybe twice that number.
Forensic teams dismantled Gacy's house. In all, they recovered 27 bodies there. How many more Gacy killed, police would never know. For 10 years, starting in 1979, Ressler interviewed Gacy in prison. Ressler was surprised to learn that he had grown up four blocks from the killer in suburban Chicago. Gacy even remembered delivering groceries to the Ressler family, recalling in detail the distinctive flower pots that Ressler's mother used. Gacy also had darker recollections. He described for Ressler a turbulent relationship with his father. Ressler wasn't surprised. Nearly all the serial killers he knows of tell similar stories.
And it's all documented. I ran away from home, as you know, when I was 19 years old because I couldn't get along with my father. I mean, he was just overbearing. I was dumb and stupid, never would amount to anything. And so I just took off and said, to hell with it. I was gone for 3 months. Well,
it's more likely. From prison, Gacy made a painting and sent it to Ressler. It depicted Gacy dressed in a clown costume.
When I got into clown makeup, I regressed into childhood. It was fun being a clown because you could be yourself or just let yourself go and act a fool. You know how people, if you're a businessman, you've got to keep a certain rapport and stuff like that, and everybody looks for you for an image. But as a clown with the makeup on, you could be slapstick and funny and have a good time. That's why I always enjoyed clowning.
In Gacy's painting, he stands in a grove of evergreen trees, surrounded by balloons. The inscription on the back reads, "You cannot hope to enjoy the harvest without first laboring in the fields." Gacy refused to explain the painting's meaning to Ressler or to anyone else. Ressler believes the painting hints at many more murders Gacy committed.
He said, "You can get away with a lot of things when you're behaving as a clown, because people see you as something funny. They see you as something as amusing. They don't know what's beneath the grease paint. They don't know what's beneath the cloth." He said, "Clowns can get away with murder."
John Wayne Gacy died by lethal injection on May 10th, 1994. Since the early years of criminal profiling in the 1970s. Other serial murderers have been identified and caught. Such names as Son of Sam, Ted Bundy, and Jeffrey Dahmer have become known to mindhunters and to a public alternately fascinated and repelled by their crimes.
Serial killers are driven by control, by dominance, by discipline, by authority. They have very warped concepts of interaction with another human being. They don't look at another human being as a human being, they look at them as an object.
Robert Ressler believes that serial killing, while not limited to the United States, has intensified in this country since the end of World War II. Part of the reason has to do with a culture that glamorizes and encourages violence.
Culture produces violent crime. I would say 75% of the world's serial killers are American products. Yeah, it sounds very strange, but it's one of our, it's like America, it's like a baseball, apple pie, mom, and serial homicide. It's unfortunate, and it's certainly tragic in a sense, but it's one thing in the world of criminology. The United States is absolutely broken all records.
Profilers must take care that the poisonous thoughts of those they track don't pollute their own. For one who stares into the abyss, there is a danger of falling in. Ressler says that mind hunters must work their way back from the brink every day of their lives.
I've maintained a balance, I think, consciously, by isolating myself from the horror of what I see. I go to work at 8, I quit at 5, I go back to a normal life, I have a drink, I watch the news, I cut the grass. I've kept a perspective. I've kept in tune with the mainstream and the normal people of society.
For Ressler, profiling is less about drama than about analysis. Observe, think, conclude, and realize there are no easy or quick answers.
In the movie concepts is that the profiler will solve the case, everybody can fold up their tents and go home. Profiling is one tool in the overall toolbox of the investigator. It gives him one more dimension, one more piece of that puzzle. And when you put it all together, sometimes it's very effective.
Profilers explore the mind's darkest regions, dragging what's hidden into the light of day. Only then can it be examined and learned from.
The value of profiling, as in this case of Richard Chase, is to give the police some concept, some psychological portrait or an image of the logical type of subject that they're looking for, to give them a clear picture, because otherwise it's just an empty room.
These human monsters feel they can never be caught, that they are invulnerable. Yet with each new victim, each drop of blood, each fiber or DNA strand left at the scene of a crime, the mind hunters probe deeper into the killer's mind. Perhaps the day will come when profilers won't be needed, but for now, the mind hunters will have to continue looking into the abyss.